April 6, 1994. A missile streaks through the Rwandan sky, bringing down a presidential jet. Within hours, machetes emerge from hiding places across the country. Roadblocks spring up like weeds. Radio announcers begin their deadly work, instructing listeners in cheerful voices to cut down the tall trees. And in the chaos, a hotel manager clutches his most powerful weapon, not a gun, but a black leather phone directory and cases of Belgian beer. Paul Rusesabin's story defies Hollywood's vision of heroism. There are no dramatic shootouts, no daring escapes through jungles. Instead, there's something far more unsettling. A man in a business suit negotiating the price of human lives over glasses of Johnny Walker, flattering killers with blood on their boots, turning a luxury hotel into a fragile island of sanity in an ocean of madness. Over 76 days, he sheltered 1,268 people, using nothing more than words, whiskey, and an unshakable belief in the power of hospitality. His account forces us to confront an uncomfortable truth. Civilization is thinner than we imagine, and its defense sometimes requires making deals with the devil himself. Picture a hillside in Central Africa, where the world is named in vowels that roll off the tongue, like water and yoni, bird, amata, milk, amabuye. This is where identity begins. Not in the rigid categories that would later tear Rwanda apart, but in the rhythm of daily work, grinding cassava, tending goats, watching banana trees sparkle across the valley. Growing up in a three-room mud house as one of nine children, Rusesabagina learned his most important lessons from his father, Thomas Rupfure, an impossibly tall man who spoke in proverbs and never raised his voice. When disputes arose in their village, they were settled through gachacha, justice on the grass, where adversaries shared banana beer through a communal straw after reaching resolution. This was secular communion, recognizing a fundamental truth. It's nearly impossible to hate someone with whom you've shared a drink. His father taught through stories, including one about a man who sheltered a wounded lion. The moral was simple. If you can harbor a fierce beast, why not a fellow human being? Young Paul absorbed this as gospel, never imagining this lesson would be tested when neighbors arrived at his door carrying machetes, demanding he hand over the cockroaches hiding inside. At 5 years old, Rusesabagina watched his father shelter frightened Tutsi strangers fleeing the Hutu Revolution of 1959. That night, they slept outside, not for adventure, but because his father feared someone might burn their house down. This early experience planted seeds that would bloom decades later when he faced his own moment of moral choice. Rwanda's tragedy is absurd. Hutus and Tutsis share the same language, religion, traditions, and often physical appearance. The division isn't ancient tribal hatred, but a recent invention by British explorer John Hanning Speke in 1863. Observing taller cattle herders, he theorized they were a lost Christian tribe from the Middle East, noble blood mixed with inferior Bantu-speaking Hutus, supposedly cursed descendants of Noah's son Ham. This racist fantasy became policy when Belgian colonizers issued identity cards in 1933, transforming fluid social categories into rigid castes. Rwanda's class system originated from cows, not bloodlines. Those with cattle became privileged Tutsis. Those without became Hutus. Ethnicity passed through fathers, making identity a bureaucratic designation rather than cultural reality. Rusesabagina first experienced this poison at 19 when his best friend Gerard was expelled from school in 1973. They'd grown up together, but Gerard's Tutsi father made him expendable. It was the first time Rusesabagina saw himself not as Paul, but as Hutu, a label that saved his life while condemning his talented friend to selling banana beer instead of becoming an engineer. Colonial inventions destroyed futures based on nothing more than paternal lineage recorded on paper. Rusesabagina's path to hotel management was accidental. destined for ministry, he was baptized at 13, choosing Paul after the apostle who described himself as all things to all people. His surname means warrior that disperses the enemies, a prophetic choice. But seminary disappointed him. He craved the modern world. A friend offered him a front desk position at Hotel Mill Colleen's, where he discovered his calling. He excelled at handling complaints, learning that listening transformed irate guests into allies. Training in Kenya and Switzerland taught him wines, bookkeeping, and discreet service. Seminary had taught him crucial insight. People rarely change minds based on facts. Emotions drive decisions, later justified with convenient reasoning. By 1992, he became general manager of Hotel Diplomats, the company's first Black GM. He perfected making powerful guests feel appreciated with small gifts, lobster dinners, premium drinks, satisfying the universal hunger for recognition. Meanwhile, on August 8, 1993, Radio Television Libre de Mille Collines began broadcasting with irreverent DJs and Congolese music. Few knew President Habyarimana was its largest shareholder. Broadcasts grew venomous. Tutsis became cockroaches. This primitive ideology spread gradually, sneering comments before escalating violence. Stripping humanity from an entire group takes time. Months before genocide, a UN informant warned of 1,700 trained extermination squads. General Romeo Dallaire urgently requested permission to raid arms, but was rebuffed by Kofi Annan, who said such action was beyond the mandate. When Habyarimana's plane was shot down on April 6, 1994, the killing began within minutes. Rusi Sabagina sheltered 32 neighbors that first night, remembering his father's lesson about protecting strangers. The next morning brought surreal horror. His gentle banker neighbor Marcel now wore a military uniform, carrying a blood-dripping machete, coldly explaining that the enemy is among us. Obsessed with reaching Hotel Diplomats, Rusi Sabagina negotiated passage for his family, secretly including all neighbors. At a roadblock stacked with bodies, a captain thrust a rifle at him, demanding he kill the cockroaches as initiation. But Rusi Sabagina noticed something crucial. The captain wouldn't look him in the eye. In that small gesture, he sensed room to maneuver. "I don't know how to handle a gun," he said calmly. When morality failed, he switched tactics. "My friends, you're tired, hungry, thirsty." He was aiming for one thought: cash. They settled on 1 million Rwandan francs. Though loathsome to reward killers, he never broke promises. In Rwanda, they say, with a lie, you can eat once, but never twice. He moved to Hotel Mille Collines, where 400 refugees had gathered. The UN evacuated most forces, leaving only four peacekeepers, worse than useless, creating false hope while lacking authorization to intervene. The hotel was surrounded by a flimsy bamboo fence, providing only psychological protection. Yet inside, Rusi Sabagina created something extraordinary: humanity fighting evil with decency. Pool water flushed toilets. 2,000 airline meal trays fed people initially. When supplies dwindled, staff purchased corn and beans, cooking over fires beneath the giant ficus tree, serving vegetable gruel on Hotel China. The lawn that once hosted diplomatic receptions now gathered exhausted refugees determined to survive another day. When phone service died, Rusi Sabagina discovered the fax machine's direct line still worked. He stayed up until 4 a.m. sending urgent faxes to foreign governments while spending surreal evenings over drinks with blood-stained men discussing lives as casually as kitchen orders. When journalist Thomas Kamilindi gave a radio interview describing hotel conditions, genociders issued a death order. An army colonel arrived demanding that dog, Thomas. Rusi Sabagina invited him to his office, offered drinks, and spent hours deflecting by appealing to the colonel's vanity. "You're too high-ranking for such insulting work." He sent him home with wine, promising to compromise tomorrow. The colonel never returned. These negotiations taught him a disturbing truth. People maintain contradictory attitudes simultaneously. Nazi guards operated gas chambers, then played with their children. He sought the soft places within them to exploit. By late May, 1,268 people were crammed into a hotel designed for 300. Nobody was killed or beaten in the Mil Colleens. Rusis Abagina was simply doing his job, though his job now included keeping money in the safe for one final bribe, not for survival, but for quick deaths by bullet rather than machete. While Rwanda suffered, American diplomats carefully avoided the word genocide. A Pentagon memo explicitly warned against phrasing that might commit the U.S. government to actually do something. The State Department's careful wording, acts of genocide may have occurred, deliberately sidestepped intervention obligations. At 4 a.m. one morning, Lieutenant Magesa ordered immediate hotel evacuation, spelling certain death for the refugees. Through frantic calls, Rusis Abagina got the order rescinded, then boldly bluffed genocide leader Colonel Bagosora, threatening to close his hotel unless he returned their water truck and safely delivered hiding neighbors. During a May 3rd evacuation attempt, RTLM Hate Radio announced his family's names as escaping cockroaches. The convoy was attacked. Militia beat refugees, including his wife, while his son surrendered his shoes to a former classmate, now wielding a machete. Militia herded everyone to the swimming pool, likely planning a massacre. General Bizimungu arrived with drawn pistol, threatening to kill any attacker. The militia retreated. On July 4th, the RPF captured Kigali, finding a ruined city with only 30,000 people remaining, a tenth of its former population. Churches bloodied, hospitals looted, corpses everywhere. Traveling south after the genocide, Rusis Abagina found Rwanda eerily silent, bodies scattered everywhere, dogs fighting over remains. In Nyanza, most of Tatiana's family lay slaughtered by neighbors, including her generous mother, who had always shared food with everyone. Crouching in the ruins, murderous hatred surged through him. He'd saved over 1,000 strangers, but couldn't save his own family. A false accusation forced him to flee to Belgium, where he bought a taxi and worked 5 a.m. to 7 p.m. Among Rwandan expatriates there, ethnic divisions dissolved. They're simply Rwandans now. In a village south of Kigali, a former church memorial displays shelves of skulls. Despite never-again pledges after the Holocaust, genocide persists. One imprisoned killer noted, "At first, we worked fast because we were eager. In the middle, we killed casually." Rwanda's current silence troubles him. The country teems with uncommunicative, angry people, potential kindling for future violence. President Kagame's government maintains power through an elite group, merely switching actors while maintaining racial politics. Yet hope existed in darkness. Thousands protected others during the genocide. A Muslim man sheltered 30, citing the Quran. Father Hakizimana protected over 2,000. These heroes saw beyond temporary madness. At the Mil Colleens, extreme pragmatism converted tools of death into survival. For 76 days, one man maintained this fragile defense through ordinary hotel management, a bartender who knows which general prefers cognac, who understood that everyone wants to feel important. The question isn't whether killing seasons will return, but whether enough ordinary people will choose to be extraordinary when that moment arrives.